All right, let's get to the interview. Yanis Varoufakis is the guest for this week. He's a Greek economist, political leader, and author of several books. He was Greece's finance minister briefly in 2015. Also, he's a former member of the Greek parliament as part of the Syriza party, which is a center-left to left-wing party in Greece. Author of Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism. That's what we'll be discussing. His idea, his concept, his theory around techno-feudalism, the idea that big tech has replaced capitalism's twin pillars, markets and profit, with its platforms and rents. With every click and scroll, we labor like serfs to increase its power. I'm a serf. If you make content, you're a serf. And I'll be back next week with another show. But until then, here's the interview. Hello, Yanis. Thank you for joining me. I think before we plunge into your book, which is provocative and very enlightening and gave me much to think about, why don't we begin by laying out your thesis? I'm sure you're asked this often in interviews, but before we talk, let's have a foundation for discussing what you mean by this idea that capitalism is dead and has been replaced by techno-feudalism.
Just by stating that hypothesis, it is a little bit like inviting opprobrium and mockery, because wherever we look, what we see is the triumph of capital. So how dare I claim that capitalism is dead? What killed it? Who killed it? Well, this is the paradox in my thesis. Exactly because capital has become so triumphant, so dominant, it has demolished all obstacles to its reproduction and accumulation by the left, by trade unions, by socialism, social democracy, even by liberal social democratic attempts to regulate it. Because it has been so triumphant, it has evolved and mutated into a mutation, into a mutant that is so toxic that, like a stupid virus that becomes overpotent, kills its host being capitalism. So capitalism has been killed in my book, at least in my thesis, by capital itself, and not any kind of capital, by this mutant capital, which I call cloud capital. And this is the difference between capital as we know it, as we have known it forever. So like a fishing rod or a tractor or even an industrial road, a robot, an industrial robot that is all singing, all dancing, building Teslas. These are all produced means of production. They are machines that we created in order to build other stuff, other machines, goods, services, and so on. Now, the cloud capital is the kind of capital that allows you to interface with big tech, essentially. Algorithmic capital, which of course is real capital, it's machinery, it's optic fiber cables and servers and cell phone towers and all that. That's real machinery too. But unlike industrial robots, steam engines and tractors and fishing rods, these are not produced means of production. They are produced means of behavioral modification. Their task is to modify our behavior. So to cut the long story short, my point is that this cloud capital has allowed certain capitalists, who are capitalists, like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and so on, essentially to create digital fiefdoms like Amazon.com, which is not a market. It looks like a market, but it's not a market. It belongs to one man. There are lots of buyers and lots of sellers, but we cannot transact with one another freely. We can only be matched through Jeff's algorithm. So he has a fiefdom, a digital fiefdom, in which vassal capitalists and cloud serfs like us, the rest who are not producing anything or not selling anything on it, were matched with a view to maximizing the rents. The ground rent, or if you want more accurately, the cloud rent of Jeff Bezos. So if I'm right in my proposition that around 40% of GDP in the United States, as we speak, and more, much more in terms of capitalization of companies, is now in the form of a kind of rent, which a new techno-feudal ruling class is charging capitalists, vassal capitalists, in order to allow them to sell their wares on those cloud fiefs. That's not capitalism, folks, anymore. Welcome to techno-feudalism.
And to share with people who are tuned into our discussion here, I have a quote from your book that I pulled to pull us deeper into our conversation. Consider what cloud capital consists of: smart software, server farms, cell towers, thousands of miles of optic fiber, and yet all of this would be worthless without content. The most valuable part of the stock of cloud capital is not its physical components, but rather the stories posted on Facebook, the videos uploaded to TikTok and YouTube, the photos on Instagram, the jokes and insults on Twitter, the reviews on Amazon, or simply our movement through space, allowing our phones to alert Google Maps to the latest spot of traffic. And then I have the rest of it here. In providing these stories, videos, photos, jokes, and movements, it is we who produce and reproduce outside any market the stock of cloud capital. The reason I bring this into our conversation is because I found this to be one of the most insightful observations about our transformation, you know, that idea that we are feeding it, you know, and that's what we're doing today. You know, I'm going to go post this on a platform and share it in the hopes that people will watch and engage with it. And to the extent that I'm, you know, doing this as a part of my job as a professional journalist, I am hoping to some degree that this will bring me some income, maybe. It probably won't be anything on par or equal to what people 20, 30 years were able to bring in for their work if they were engaged in this sort of endeavor. But I am hopeful that people will tune into this interview I am reproducing for the cloud.
Of course, I agree entirely with you. This is exactly what's going on. And let's not forget that what you're doing, even though it will bring you some money, a portion of what you would have made once upon a time working as a waged journalist, what you're doing is you're creating a lot more rent for the owners of YouTube and other such cloud thieves. Because with every person who tunes in, these cloudalists, as I call the owners of cloud capital, what they do is they manage to enhance and enrich the patent information that I have over those thousands of users, so that they can then bring them into much more firmly into their cloud fiefdoms, where they can match them with sellers and sell them other stuff. And while doing that, they're not working on behalf of the sellers. It's a mistake to think of this cloud capital as a service sector for capitalists. Once upon a time, it was. So, you know, I use, as you probably know, noticed in my book, the fictional character of Don Draper, the great guru of advertising that we all watched in Mad Men. Great series, television series that was. Don Draper was smart. He was whimsical. He was very creative. And he came up with ads that enhanced the capacity of his clients to sell things to us. But in the end, he was dependent on them. So if Coca-Cola or McDonald's or Bethlehem Steel did not hire him, he was out of a job. And he was just a waged professional, service sector professional. That's what he was. So the capitalists back then, who were manufacturing the goods that Don Draper was pushing to us, promoting, they were in control. The capitalists were in control, and Don Draper managed to get a very nice salary out of them, or, you know, a cut from the sales. But today, the owner of the cloud capital, who doesn't have to be creative at all, right? He just has the algorithms like Zuckerberg or Bezos. They are in control. They are the ruling class. It is not the producers of the steel, of the hamburgers, of the soft drinks, of the sodas and so on. They are vassals because they are also drawn into these cloud fiefdoms like Amazon.com. And they are being skimmed and scammed by those cloudalists. So this is a magnificent transformation. Because, you know, some people talk about surveillance, capitalism, and so on. I don't buy that. This is not just software, which somebody produces and sells to the standard monopoly capitalists, who then use it in order to brainwash us. No. These bits of machinery that are networked with one another, what I call cloud capital, they draw both buyers and sellers into these cloud fiefs and exploit them both. And that is a very different system to capitalism. That's why I've dropped the word capitalism. And that has not made me very popular, especially amongst the left. Because the left has a great connection with the word capitalism. Which I understand as a leftist, but nevertheless, we need to wean ourselves of it.
And so with this rise of cloud capital, you have a new class that you identify as the cloudalists. You've been mentioning them already, but I want to bring in, when I was reading your book, I got to a section of it that I was very glad that you mentioned this individual, because I was thinking of them myself. You write, "If I had to choose one person to illustrate the need for techno-feudalism, both word and concept, in order to understand our collective predicament, it would be Elon Musk." So as I was reading along, I'm seeing this description of the cloudalists and what they have been able to do. And I was thinking that this disruptor, this figure who has so captivated the world's attention, and yet people don't ever really seem to be able to describe him appropriately as to like what he was doing. I think that the section of your book where you address Elon Musk actually gets much closer than many of the pundits when it comes to understanding the figure of Elon Musk. But can you describe why you believe he so personifies or represents techno-feudalism?
The reason is that, you know, Musk started as a standard capitalist. Unlike Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg went straight into cloud capital. Facebook, right? The people behind Google, straight to cloud capital. They'd never made anything before. They never produced anything, any tangible material commodity. Musk, with Tesla, he upended the car industry. He created a new kind of car, an electric car that actually competes with Mercedes-Benzes and Volvos and Toyotas. So he built that. It was standard capitalist work. He also created SpaceX, which, though space age and not of this earth, again, it's a standard capitalist enterprise. You can imagine somebody like Henry Ford or Westinghouse or Edison doing it. He has Neuralink, which is a company that already has not produced anything yet that is sellable. But again, it is a tangible combination of a product and a service. It's a product because it's got, you know, it's an implant that you put into your brain. And if you are quadriplegic, the idea is that at some point it will help you move your armchair or your exoskeleton or whatever, and it will give you motion. These are standard capitalist exercises. But at some point, he drops all this and goes headlong into buying Twitter with all the furor that had caused. Of course, he waltzed into Twitter like a bull in a china shop and broke lots of things and upset a lot of people and did very silly things. And nevertheless, and everybody thought, what a fool, you know, just a boy that wants a new toy. I could not believe that, because whatever you may think about Elon Musk, he's not a fool. And he's not somebody who would risk, you know, 40 billion of his fortune or of his company's fortune in order to buy Twitter and then break it. For me, it was clear what was going on. Elon Musk understands the power of cloud capital. Indeed, he understands, and he said that before, not in my own terminology, but more or less the same thing. He understands that, he understood from the beginning that Teslas were far more valuable than Volkswagens or BMWs or Mercedes-Benzes, because they had the capacity to communicate with the cloud that German cars don't. So in a sense, you could see that by selling you a Tesla, he grabbed you forever in the cloud, because he would always know what your music you're listening to while you're driving, where you're going, what music you're listening to when you're going to the supermarket, as opposed to when you're going to see your boyfriend or girlfriend, right? And all that is just immensely important, rich data that has a market value and which he can monetize. But he did not have an interface between himself and you, other than his car. Bezos had Amazon, Zuckerberg had Facebook, and so on and so forth. And it's not easy to create one of these interfaces from scratch, as we know with Blue Sky and various other alternatives to existing platforms. So Twitter was the only one which was approachable, which was for sale. He grabbed it. And when he talked about turning it into an everything app, that's exactly what he had in mind. He had in mind a way of merging his mechanical capital, his old-fashioned capital, like cars and rockets and, you know, drills for his boring company and so on, blending mechanical capital with cloud capital. That was my interpretation of what he was doing. And it doesn't really matter whether you like him or you dislike him, whether you agree with him, you don't agree with him, you think he's dangerous or you think he's great. It is a very big mistake to underestimate his capacity to home in on the importance of blending his mechanical capital with cloud capital.
And then I have one more aspect of your book specifically, and then more loose questions for the rest of our conversation. This doesn't have to be like I'm doing a professorial class or anything, but I thought this breakdown of what the cloudless had changed was, you know, really boiled down to the essence of what people should recognize. And so I broke it out into these bullets. That's not how you wrote it in the book, but you have the idea of what constitutes a commodity being changed, the ideal of the autonomous individual being changed, the ownership of identity being changed, the propagation of culture being changed, the context of politics being changed, the nature of the state being changed, and the texture of geopolitics being changed. So maybe you can dive into that and give some more detail to those bullets. But in moving our discussion along, I also invite you to address these historical events that are highlighted in your book as being key moments in techno-feudalism's history. The pandemic in 2020, and then even earlier, you have the 2008 economic collapse or crisis and the ripple effects, the shock waves that were sent throughout the economic system.
Sure. Look, the first event is before 2008. It's the privatization of the internet. The original internet was a commons. It was a capitalism-free zone. I remember that. I'm old enough to remember Internet One, when we users simply owned the place. You know, people wrote programs and threw them to the wind, to the internet digital wind. So even today, when you go into a website, you use HTTP, which is a protocol that somebody wrote, didn't earn a single penny for it. A bit like the Pentagon giving us GPS for free. We don't have to pay for GPS because Pentagon decided they will not charge us. They could have decided to charge us. That would be a very different world. Anyway, so the privatization of the internet brought about the creation of big tech. That's the first big step around the late 1990s, early 2000s. Then comes 2008 with the collapse of Wall Street, which precipitated the complete collapse of all banks in Europe, every single one of them. The debt crisis, the Great Recession, and then the Great Stagnation. Remember, central banks were trying to create inflation they couldn't, which is, you know, if Milton Friedman had heard that, he would have freaked that the central bank is trying to pump money. Well, not this time, he's pumping money, huge quantities of money into the economy, and no inflation happens. Okay. Of course, the reason for that was because our governments were practicing austerity at the same time. So the little people didn't have money to spend. So as the central bank pumped money into the financial circuits, into finance, into the big banks would never lend it to the little people because the little people were impecunious. Why give them money when they didn't have any? The banks never give money to anyone who needs it, right? They only give it back to people who don't need it. It's a basic principle of banking.
Exactly.
So they would pick up the phone and they would call their usual clients. Anyone from Apple to, you know, General Motors. Now, General Motors looks at the people that are there saying, as if they're going to be able to buy an expensive new model. So I'm not going to take any money from the bank in order to invest in a new expensive competitor to Tesla or Mercedes-Benz because the people out there don't have enough money. But they took the money anyway, because it was free. It was, came at zero interest rate, more or less. And they took it to Wall Street and they bought back their own shares. So General Motors shares were going up even though they were not selling more cars. The only capitalists who actually invested in the real machinery were the globalists, the big tech. And for 13 long years, they took the money that the state produced to build up their cloud capital and their cloud fiefs. So that's the second major milestone in the history of the emergence of techno-feudalism. And then you're right to mention the pandemic, because what the pandemic did was, I mean, even if the pandemic had not happened, we would still have techno-feudalism. But it turbocharged it because, as you know, as you remember, Amazon suddenly became the Red Cross when we were locked up. They were sending us packets. Well, we paid for them, but you know what I mean? Like the Red Cross used to send packets to the prisoners of war, the prisoners in prison or POW camps. Similarly, they were sending packets to all of us. And, you know, you had Zoom, which emerged during the pandemic. So there was a major boost that cloudalists received, which simply sped up the coming of techno-feudalism. But for me, what made techno-feudalism irreversible was the combination of the privatization of the internet and the $35 trillion that the central banks of the G7 printed in order to save the bankers.
One of the things that I observed as a person living through this global pandemic, and then you bring it up so very well in your book, is that we were spiraling into this economic crisis. And then as you observed what was happening, the stock markets weren't going down. The shocks that we were supposed to feel, they weren't translating to the pocketbooks or the checkbooks of these executives and their firms as they were trying to manage these companies. And so it's maybe a bit of a tangent from the natural progression of your book and how you lay out all of your thoughts, but I feel like this is a good point for me to ask you how you feel about all the different types of disasters and calamities that humanity can face, and if there's something unique about cloud capital or techno-feudalism, since that's what you're putting it under, techno-feudalism, that makes it more capable of adapting than capitalism. Is there something about it? Maybe I'm not asking the correct question. You can redirect me, but the pandemic, climate catastrophes, maybe even wars. Is there something about techno-feudalism that perhaps insulates them a bit more than if it was just the capitalism that leftists have typically deconstructed?
The development which renders the cloudalists more resistant to the vagaries of politics? Are the algorithms within the empires of cloud capital which poison democracy? Because let's face it, democracy was always the scourge of the powerful. The powerful, the aristocrats, the rulers, never, I mean, they loathe democracy. They hate the idea of the demos being in power, because then what happens to their power? The fact of the matter, you know, when Elon Musk talks about Twitter as the public square, he's poking fun at us because he's too smart to believe it. His algorithms, and the algorithms before he bought Twitter, that's not down to him. These are how these algorithms work. We know from whistleblowers that have worked for Facebook and others that it was not a subconscious project. It was a conscious attempt by those who coded the algorithms of Facebook, of Twitter, of Instagram. It was a conscious decision, a project, a real project, to poison the conversation, to stir up anger, because anger, rage, what it does, it motivates you to stay longer on your screen, and therefore to share more of your data, and therefore to become a far better cloud surf for these cloudalists. So the conversation has been poisoned with good reason from the perspective of the cloudalists. And thus our capacity to have a democratic debate amongst ourselves, and therefore the probability that we can come up with a consensus that may be inimical to the interest of those who are already in power, shrinks. So in that sense, cloudalists are more immune to democracy than capitalists used to be. Because if you think about, you know, Henry Ford created the production line. The production line put a lot of workers together. They could talk to one another. They could form a union. They could resist Henry Ford. Now the algorithms are primed to poison our relationship amongst each other, right? And to create xenophobia, to create racism, to create intolerance, and so on. So that's what works in favor of the cloudalists. But there are forces working against them. You mentioned a couple, and I'll mention the third. One is, of course, the very quick march towards climate catastrophe, because their algorithms are preventing us from coming to a consensus on what to do in order to avert humanity's, you know, rush to fall off a cliff. And, you know, nobody is immune to that, not even the cloudalists. So, you know, these people may build bunkers under their mansions in Hawaii, but I don't know what the point is of surviving a catastrophe in a bunker. I'd much rather die on the surface very quickly. The quicker the better, actually. The second reason why they are moving also towards their own disaster is, of course, the intensity and the growing intensity of the new Cold War between the United States and China, which I explained in my book as the almighty clash between the two centers of cloud capital on the planet, being the United States and China. That is, for me, what's behind the clash between Washington and Beijing. It's nothing to do with Taiwan. It's got nothing to do with spying. It's nothing to do with trade. None of that. I mean, all that was relevant in the 1990s, but it didn't lead to a Cold War between the United States and China. What has changed is that China is the only country in the world that has a competitor to Google, a competitor to Facebook, a competitor to Tesla, a competitor to all the big tech companies in the United States. And they actually, some of those things, they can do better than the American cloud capitalists. Okay. That I think is also really important. Capitalism was always prone to crisis. We've seen that, you know, every 10 years there was a major recession in the United States and Europe. There was even a very big slump in Japan. And occasionally in 1929 and in 2008, there was more than just a recession. There was a crash, an almighty crash. So capitalism was always creating crises. They were coming out of the same production line as iPhones and cars were. But techno-feudalism, and I try to explain this in the book, creates even bigger crises. Is even less stable than capitalism. It increases its tendency, propensity towards instability and collapse. Why? Because if I'm right in what I'm saying that the cloudalists skim off the surplus value of capitalists, the vast majority of it, well, what happens to that money? It disappears from the circular flow of income. Because, you know, Jeff Bezos has what, 250 billion? If we give him another billion, what is he going to do with it? Nothing. I mean, a human being cannot spend all this money. They can't spend, they accumulate, right? So the money, it is as if the money, it goes under the mattress. It leaves a circular flow of income, which means it depresses further aggregate demand, which means it depresses investment in standard capital, you know, like machines. And so that means that it reduces the quality of jobs for people out there. So that creates even more poison politics. That poisons our democracies even more. And then the central banks have to replenish this economic activity that has been taken out by printing more money. So even when there is inflation and they want to reduce the supply of money in order to arrest inflation, they have a good reason to print more money. So central bankers are at a loss. They have no idea what to do. They are damned if they do, and they are damned if they don't. Okay? So that thus society becomes even more unstable as a result of the power of techno-feudal lords. And to the extent that they need to live in this society, I mean, they can live behind gated communities and, you know, they can build bunkers. But what kind of a life is that?
You're speaking to me from Athens, just to make sure that people understand that we should consider what has been happening to Europe and what all of this transformation means for that part of the world. As you lay out in your book, we touched on China. Maybe we'll come back to it, but I do think it's important to give attention, because the people who listen to my show and watch it, they've heard us discuss what the war in Ukraine has basically meant for people of Europe and how it has wrecked their economies. In this book, you know, you're focusing on the cloud capital or the techno-feudalism and the fact that Europe is not China. And that Europe does not have these companies and firms that are able to counter some of the, I guess, effects of being in this new world that is techno-feudal. Maybe you can unpack that a little bit more.
Europe is the stupid continent. We have the richest populations per capita. We are the richest continent in the world per capita. We have very smart people, very well-educated cultural people, you know, lots of classical music, great art, produced, you know, Ferraris and Lamborghinis, very nice handbags. And we have museums, we have cathedrals, we have everything, right? And we are yet the stupid continent. We're the continent of the last 15 years. We have not invested anything, because we have created a common currency, the euro, which has had a spasm. And how could it not have a spasm? Because think of what we did. You know, if you and I were sitting in a coffee, in a cafeteria, in a cafe, you know, 20 years ago, and I were to give you my idea, my great plan, let's create a central bank without a state, and then have 20 countries, almost 20 countries, that don't have a central bank, but use the money that one central bank, which has no state, is producing. You would have thought that I'm mad, and yet that's what we created. So imagine if the Fed didn't have a federal government behind it. And imagine if all the states in the United States had no FDIC to run to if some bank went bankrupt. You know, America would be in the stupid state in which Europe is now. So for 15 years, we've been bailing out Greece and banks and so on, and Ireland and Portugal, and banks, and banks, and banks. You know, just one bailout of the other, right? Practicing socialism for the bankers, you know, printing money to give to the bankers, and harsh austerity for everybody else. So, and we don't have the dollar. At least in the United States, you have the dollar. So you can effectively print the currency in which everybody is trading. We print the euro, which people will want only if they want to buy something from Europeans, unlike the dollar. I mean, we want the dollar, we non-European, non-Americans, even if we don't want to buy anything from you. That's a unique position to find yourself in. So we don't have that kind of thing, and we practice austerity. For 15 years, we have not been investing. If you go to Germany today, you'll find, even in ministries, advanced ministries of the Federal Republic of Germany, you'll find they're still using faxes. I'm not joking. They're still using faxes because they have not invested in digital technology in Germany, the richest country in the world. The richest country in the world, the country with the largest surpluses. Yeah. Meanwhile, the Americans and the Chinese have been investing massively in cloud capital. We haven't. So there's no European Google, there's no European Facebook, there's no European Tesla, there's no European any of the Magnificent Seven, right? And remember, the Magnificent Seven, if you look at their capitalization, and by that I mean Alphabet, Google, Microsoft, Apple, Nvidia, and so on, their capitalization is greater than the capitalization of the whole of Germany, France, Japan, Britain, and China together. Okay? And Europe has none of that. That explains why we are so geostrategically irrelevant. It explains why Volkswagen, even if they manage to build a lot of electric cars, they will not be able to make a profit, a serious profit. Because unlike Tesla with Elon Musk and Twitter and so on, they have no access to cloud capital because Europe has no cloud capital. So we are falling behind when it comes to green technologies, green energy, and also we don't have a federal government. We have federal money without a federal government. I mentioned that before. But that's also pertinent because you mentioned Ukraine. Well, to highlight the irrelevance of Europe and the stupidity of this continent, and I count myself as part of this celebration of idiocy. Suppose that tomorrow morning there is a peace conference to resolve the Ukrainian war. I hope there is one. Personally, I'd love to see one where, you know, you have Zelensky representing the Ukrainians, Putin representing the Russians, Biden representing the United States, Xi representing China, Modi representing India. Who is going to represent Europe? You only need to ask this question and then you realize what I'm talking about, because there's no one to represent you. Not only don't we have a government, a federal government with a president, a prime minister, a guru, something, but even the our national leaders are Lilliputians. You know, take Emmanuel Macron, Olaf Scholz. They don't even have the trust of their own people, the French or the Germans. How could they have the trust of the Europeans? In any case, the Eastern Europeans, the Scandinavians, the people from the governments of Estonia, of Lithuania, consider Scholz and Macron to be very close to Putin. So they will veto them representing Europe. But who's going to pay for Europe's participation in the Ukrainian peace? And we know that it is the European Union that will have to pay for Ukraine. Americans never do. The Americans, even in the Gulf War, if you remember the first Gulf War under Bush Senior, they went in, they did all of the destruction and the fighting and the killing, and you know, some of them were killed as well. And then it was the Saudi Arabians that had to pay the bill, right? So somebody else has to pay the bill. And who is going to pay the bill? The Europeans, with no representation. So, you know, taxation, no representation. An American understands what that means. So no cloud capital, no green technologies, no geopolitical significance. To understand that, in its full-blown intensity, you've got to look at the fact that the capital, which in my estimation in my book, has mutated to becoming the main source of power in the world, cloud capital is simply non-existent in Europe.
And then to close out, you write compassionately, as anybody on the left should do, about the global South and where they find themselves. They're effectively caught in the middle here. And there has been discussion among the left about the nature of Chinese investment in the African continent, and whether that is something to be fearful of, in the sense that the Belt and Road Initiative, as you mentioned in your book, might be something different than the standard of colonialism that would have come from Belgium or, I guess, European countries earlier, that maybe they've taken a different approach. But still, it's hard to disagree with you when you write, it will take a miracle for this recently evolved species of imperialism not to result in more wars and more failed states. That, in fact, what we are seeing as part of this new Cold War, this is a battleground that will be fought. So, you know, as we wind down our conversation on techno-feudalism, some words about the people of the global South, who are always and have been for over the last 100, 200 years. And I guess you could go even further back when you consider the slave trade to North America, that these are the most underdeveloped and exploited people, this population.
2 points. Firstly, I'm always worried whenever I see moneyed people, whether they're Americans, Germans, or Chinese, going to a place like Africa with wads of money, because you know they are not philanthropic. We know that, right? But there is a fundamental difference between the way that the Europeans and the Americans went into the African continent, guns blazing. First, they sent the army. Think of Belgian Congo. They went in there, they destroyed everything, they killed anyone who resisted them, and they took the loot and left, leaving behind a black hole. Or they stole their people, the slave trade, as you put it. The Chinese need to be looked at in a nuanced way, because it has to be recognized that they are not imperialists in the standard way. They have never been preceded by troops. They didn't overthrow a single government. It's not like the United States that, you know, destroyed the Congo by murdering Patrice Lumumba, right? So there are no Chinese secret agents killing politicians and overthrowing regimes, and there are no troops of, you know, the Red Army marching across Africa. That has to be understood. And whenever I hear Washington or European capitals denouncing China for imperialism, I think, my God, what audacity do they have? You know, who are they? Anyway, having said that, there can be predatory lending, and there has been predatory lending by the Chinese. Not all of it. A lot of it was given, a lot of money was given away. In Ethiopia, they built a whole electricity system and telephone system for free in order to carry favor with governments. There's no doubt about that. But it's not the same thing, right, with predatory lending. And then there was predatory lending. But even when there was predatory lending, like Sri Lanka, when they really wanted to get the port of Colombo, when Sri Lanka went bankrupt, the Chinese stood back and they said, okay, we're not writing off the debt, but we're not going to destroy the people of Sri Lanka by demanding the immediate repayment. So effectively, they froze the debt and they stood back. Whereas the IMF and the international bankers, and India for that matter, are trying to extract a pound of flesh from the people of Sri Lanka as we speak. But that's the first part. The second part, in order to link it with cloud capital, there is a very bitter irony about the way in which our dematerialized capital, this is how people think of cloud capital, that it is dematerialized capital because you have your phone, you know, it is as if it is in the ether. It lives in the cloud. It doesn't live in the cloud. It lives on the earth. It's machinery. And to boot, all these technologies require particular rare earths and nickel and cobaltium and various other substances, which are mined in the old-fashioned way. So think about it. Our Tesla cars, our iPhones and Samsung phones, all these technologies that make up cloud capital, they are being serviced by labor in Africa as we speak, that mines the land in 19th century working conditions. 6 and 7 year olds work to death in deep holes underground, like they used to at the beginning of the 19th century, in order to service and to provide the raw materials for our cloud capital. And one final example. If you look at the financial press, like Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, debt restructuring and indebtedness and the debt crisis of the global south, and all these people have to pay their debts and so on. Take Zambia. Zambia, as we speak, is in a never-ending negotiation with the International Monetary Fund, the kind of negotiation I found myself in 2015 representing Greece as its finance minister. It's never a good thing to be caught up in negotiations with the IMF on behalf of international vultures. Now, Zambia owes about $1 billion. Not that much money in the greater scheme of things. But it's bankrupt. And it really has to suffer losses of schools, of hospitals, of public services, of health, while these negotiations are continuing. Well, let me say to you that in the last 10 years, international companies have taken, extracted from Zambia, 26 billion worth. Value worth $26 billion from the land in the old traditional extractive way. 26 they took out, that country owes one, and the international community represented by IMF is crushing that country and its people down for that $1 billion after it has taken 26 away from it. That's colonialism.
All right, I'll let you go, but I can't let you leave this interview without asking you, because I've spent so much time reporting on WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, and you're recognized as a big prominent supporter, I think probably even a friend, and had the chance to meet him while he was in the living in the Ecuador embassy. Are there any techno-feudalism leaks from WikiLeaks? Is there anything important that Julian Assange brought to us? Would ICESave be a major part of techno-feudalism and exposing its development? But I suppose on a more pertinent note to our past week, your thoughts for Assange as we await this High Court of Justice decision, which is another point in this punishment by process that we've seen Assange have to suffer because the United States won't relent and drop its case against Julian Assange.
Full disclosure, he's a dear friend. I've visited him countless times in the Ecuadorian embassy. I've also visited him more than once in the Guantanamo of the United Kingdom, the Belmarsh awful high security prison. I'll mention that the last time I visited, I took a copy of Techno-Feudalism to give it to him. And the prison authorities didn't let me on the basis that he already has too many books in his cell. And I asked, how many does that mean? He said, they said two. So on Techno-Feudalism and the relationship with Julian, look, I could talk to you about this for hours, but let me remind you of something that he said once. And he said this to me and then it came out. He said that, remember when Zuckerberg had become the Time magazine's man of the year? I had a picture of him, front page, on the cover. And he said to me, Riley, he said, this man steals data from you and sells it to governments and awful conglomerates. And he becomes, you know, Time magazine's man of the year. I take information from governments and conglomerates and give it to you for free. And I am an international terrorist. So I think that connects quite nicely to the you know, concept of techno-feudalism. Uh-huh. Look, Julian Assange is being killed murder daily. It's a slow murder. It's not a slow death. It's a slow murder. They are intending to kill him. Under, you know, he's under conditions of solitary confinement, 23 hours a day in Britain as we speak. And if he goes to the United States, it will be even worse because it will be an even smaller cell and even harsher conditions. You know, he's next to criminals who are convicted for 3-4 murders who get a much better treatment than he does. He's been convicted of nothing. He's being accused of journalism, as I can see you say up there. And thank you for doing that. And the whole point is to make you and people like you fear for your life if you dare expose to the world crimes against humanity that the powers that be have committed in your name, in our name. That's what it is. As for the specifics and where we are at now, I have no hope in the British High Court judges. They have demonstrated in the past that they have been completely sold down the line. They've sold their souls to the devil. There's no doubt that he should be released by them because the extradition treaty between the UK and the United States is very clear. No one gets extradited if there are political issues involved. Clearly, this is a wholly political issue. It's not a criminal case. And secondly, you know, the High Court has stopped the extradition to the United States of murderers on the basis that they feared for their life in the United States. Now, if anyone's life is threatened by the United States, that's Julian's. So there's no doubt that the British High Court is a disgrace. They have disgraced themselves. They will disgrace themselves again, I have no doubt. I hope they prove me wrong. I really hope. And then I'll apologize with immense joy. But my view is that they will send him eventually over to the United States. And when he's in the United States, he's going to be put in a Virginia Supermax prison where he's going to be for 24 hours a day, not 23 hours a day, in solitary, in a much smaller cell. And remember, he's autistic, which means that being deprived of sensory, you know, sensory deprivation for him is 1,000 times more painful than it is for you and me. And there will be a court case, which is a mockery of anything supposedly the West stands for, because even his lawyers would not know the charges. Can you please note that? His lawyers would not know the charges. His lawyers would not see the judge. They will speak through a camera to the judge. There will be no jury. Julian will never see anything. He will never be privy to any deliberation that is happening in the court on his behalf or against him. The national security apparatchik, the ones who have plotted to kill Julian, as we know very well that they have done that over the last 10 years, will be the ones who will be talking to the judge. And the judge will make a decision, 170 years in prison, there's no doubt of that. Because that's why that particular judge has been chosen, in order to deliver the verdict that has been decided in advance. The only possibility I see of seeing my friend again is if, having convicted him, because this is what you see, that's what the NSA, the CIA, the security apparatus of the United States wants. They want, what they can't stand is that he's an innocent man who's never been convicted of anything, not even a parking ticket. And they want to convict him. And the best we can hope is that the Prime Minister of Australia, Albanese, will find a way of negotiating with Biden that once he's convicted, the United States will extradite him to Australia, where he will be supposedly serving the rest of his sentence, and then the Australian government can release him on bail. That is the only chance I see of seeing my friend again. I can tell you Julian doesn't want that. He prefers to die than to be convicted for journalism. I hope to see him again.
I hope that you get to see him again. So thank you, Yanis, for taking the time for this discussion. And I wish you all the best with your book. It's fantastic. I'll go ahead and conclude the interview and let you go off. You're a busy person. Thank you for all your work. And I guess keep up the fight.
Thank you.